This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to your brand new edition of All Football Commentators Are Geeks with me, Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV.
And Alex Crook from TalkSport and National Newspaper Scribe.
Coming up this week, a broadcaster who has presented both Grandstand and Match of the Day, played for a professional football team and outdrunk Noel Gallagher.
You'd be phoning Howard Kendall up at home on a Sunday night asking him if all was well. You'd be phoning Mr. Paisley at home on a Sunday evening saying, is all well, any injury news? And just the concept in those days, having home phone numbers for football managers, phoning them and them actually taking the call. It's not better, it's not worse. It's just a very different era.
Find out which Premier League manager gagged his players after a humiliating home defeat.
Pep Guardiola gets a little bit spiky and tells me he'd rather win the Premier League than the Champions League.
Plus, we reveal the Manchester United legend who gate-crashed Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's post-match interview. That's all on the podcast that gets more excited by Peter Alice than Tiger Woods. All football commentators are geeks.
Shots on a Friday.
Back in the net!
Yeah, this lot think I'm talking about the Championship match. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Hello, how are you? Another brilliant weekend of action to discuss. Towers from the Tunnel coming up and the weekend in numbers as well. Crook and I have been bantering all week about a Masters bet because in his usual style, he's crying about tipping up a 66-1 shot, which didn't place, but he collected on because he had a bonus from a bookmaker. But you look, okay, Patrick Cantlay, well done. Fantastic. And it gave us a whole weekend of banter. So well done to you for picking out. Where did you get it from? You must have got it off. Someone must have given you a tip.
Good old-fashioned studying. Watched him play, I think, at the US Open last year. Was impressed with what I saw. Made a note. And yeah, 66-1. And listen, he led at one stage. We were all getting very excited then, weren't we?
And the putt for eagle. Like, wow. It's going to happen. We're going to collect. I don't know why we all trusted you, but there's a group of about six or seven lads that are all in the same sort of WhatsApp group. And everybody was on this particular golfer because Crook had tipped him up. I don't know why. It's not like he's got a great history of tipping winners. Anyway, moving on. Michelle's unwell again, but don't worry, we'll plow on without her today. Loads to come on the programme, including an interesting story from the tunnel at Selhurst Park and a really fascinating insight into the Brighton dressing room, which Crook has got for you in the next few minutes. Should we do Language of Love to start off with?
Yep, let's do it.
Language of love. Our favourite words in the football lexicon.
Okay, so every now and again we just throw these in, the idea of sort of working out where a certain phrase came from that is definitely in the footballing lexicon and we all use it, but maybe we use it without knowing its origin. Now, Deadly Doug Ellis, the great old Doug, who sadly passed away not so long ago, claimed to have invented this term. But did he? But do you know where the term bicycle kick actually comes from?
You stumped me again with this one. I'm glad I don't look at the script beforehand because then I would probably cheat, as is my nature. So I can't even hazard a guess. I have attempted a bicycle kick in the past. That didn't go particularly well.
It doesn't often, actually.
Probably imagine. Have you ever done one?
Never successfully, no. No, it's a very, very difficult skill and you can easily break your arm doing it or injure yourself. And that is something that we'll get onto when we reveal it a little bit later on.
Yeah, looking forward to that. We've got a cracking pod in store for you this week with some great stories from the various matches we've covered and the legend that is Ray Stubbs. You heard him in the intro. We'll also be looking back on his career. But as always, we will start by looking back at some of the more quirky facts and stats from the weekend just gone.
Raheem Sterling struck twice to help fire Manchester City to victory at Crystal Palace. Sterling has scored more goals in the last 18 months than he has in his previous six seasons combined.
Southampton all but secured safety by beating Wolves at St Mary's. Such is their turnaround under Ralf Hasenhüttl. If the league table had begun on New Year's Day, Saints would be eighth.
Paul Pogba's penalty saw Manchester United limp over the line against West Ham. The Frenchman needs to score one more spot kick to equal Ruud van Nistelrooy's Premier League club record of eight in a single season.
I was watching a documentary about him this morning. Liverpool's crucial victory over Chelsea was Jurgen Klopp's 200th game in charge of the Reds. He already has a better win percentage than any manager in their illustrious history.
Those results on Sunday means the leadership of the Premier League has changed hands 27 times over the course of the season. That tally is sure to rise again between now and the last day.
And I think this is a contender for stat of the season. Here we go. Bournemouth hammered Brighton 5-0. I was there. Brighton were dreadful. On the 13th of the 4th, 2019, with goals, wait for it, from players wearing 13, 4, 20 and 19. How spooky is that?
It deserved a drum roll, that one. It deserved a drum roll. That was great. I like that. That could be a contender for stat of the season. Not bad. There was another one, though, back in November where I think it was the 11th minute on the 11th day or something that you came up with, which was pretty good as well. So you've heard the stats behind the weekend's big stories. But what did we learn once we left the press box and headed down into the sanctity of the tunnel?
What a headshot!
It's time for Tales from the Tunnel.
So, there I was, casually interviewing a very lucky Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in the tunnel at Old Trafford. Now, the tunnel at Old Trafford is in the corner of the Stretford End and the Sir Bobby Charlton stand. It's not very often, actually. There's not too many corner tunnels now, but it's a corner tunnel, which it's just a big gap between the two stands, which is where the players come out, and then they go underneath the Sir Bobby Charlton stand into the dressing rooms, which is just off to the left of centre. And he was talking about the fact that his team had played not very well and West Ham deserved their victory but didn't get it. But he was smiling in the knowledge that even though that they were comprehensively outplayed, he'd still got the 3 points. I then asked him about whether David De Gea's save was not only the best he'd made, but maybe one of the pivotal moments in the game, because they got a massive helping hand from the crossbar as well, a couple of good decisions that went in their favour, or a couple of bad decisions that went in their favour. And Ollie was waxing lyrical about Dave. He was saying, you know, against young boys, his athleticism in training, some of the saves he makes are outstanding. I think he's the best goalkeeper we've ever had. Now, as those words pass his lips, as if by some sort of divine intervention, Ole Gunnar is reminded immediately that Manchester United actually have had some very good goalkeepers in the past. And in fact, one of these goalkeepers reminds him of this by coming up behind him and tucking his giant Danish hands around the teeny Norwegian's waist mid-interview. None other than Peter Schmeichel. Just at that moment that those words pass his lips. And Ollie, as Ollie does, just had to pivot, laugh, embrace the big Danish giant, and then come back to me and say, well, we are Manchester United. We have always got the best goalkeepers, including Peter Schmeichel, who just happened to have joined us. It was one of those sort of odd serendipitous moments where you just can't help but laugh because the timing was impeccable. And then afterwards, actually, the interview finished and the press officer and I were laughing and Ollie was laughing about it and we're just having a chat between the four of us. And someone said something like, did Ollie say that David was the best goalkeeper in the world? To which Peter Schmeichel said, remember, his son is also a goalkeeper, said, you should have said he's the best goalkeeper in the world because he is.
Mm. Wow. High praise indeed, that.
Is he? I'm not sure about that. Not this season, anyway. But no. Certainly, he was last year. All very jolly, Ollie, after what was a very bad performance.
Yeah, I don't think he'd be too jolly after Barcelona when they get hammered at the Nou Camp. I've got a controversial view on David De Gea. I think they should sell him. I just don't think he has been the goalkeeper this season that he has in previous years. I think his mind seems to be elsewhere. He's demanding mega money. I'd let him go to Real Madrid. And I actually don't think Romero would be a bad choice for replacement. I'm not necessarily sure that they need to go out and spend millions on a goalkeeper because I think they've got a decent replacement already at the club.
I think he's a good goalkeeper, Romero, and I think Jose Mourinho said on a number of occasions he's got two number ones because Romero is that good. David De Gea is always flirty with going back to Spain. They just bought Courtois, though. What are they going to do with him, Real Madrid? I don't know if that avenue is still open or not, but even so, I think PSG were more likely to be linked, weren't they, at one stage? I don't know, but I don't think you should judge him on one bad season. He has got Smalling, Jones, Young and Shaw as the back four most of the weeks. So, you know, there's other issues there that I think need sorting out, and keeping him is probably a good idea rather than a bad one. I don't know.
He deserves a knighthood for playing behind that defence for so long, let alone a move to Real Madrid. I was at Brighton, as I mentioned already, to witness one of the most shambolic performances I think I've ever seen from a Premier League team, especially at home. The way that Brighton capitulated in the final half an hour after Anthony Knockaert's brainless red card will be a major cause for concern. What was interesting after the game, Chris Hughton usually very approachable. I've got to say, he was fine with us, measured as always. But he banned his players from doing any media. No TV interviews, no sound bites for radio, and none of them stopped in the mix zone. I'm told that's because he was so furious with the way they played. Not for the first time. He was particularly raging with Knockhart over that dismissal. I'm not sure where I stand on this. I can understand his anger that they were dismal. But I think after a defeat like that, maybe it's more important than ever for the captain or someone like Glenn Murray, the elder statesman, to come out and explain themselves and say sorry to the fans, who, to be fair, they did leave in their droves at one stage, but they never turned on the team, even when they were getting battered. I mean, there was an incident at the end, I'm not sure if they showed it on Match of the Day, Bournemouth were five up, and they were literally taking it in turns to dribble their way around defenders in the penalty area. David Brooks was taken clean out. It was the clearest penalty you will ever see. And I'm convinced the referee didn't give it because he just felt sorry for Brighton and he didn't want to inflict any more punishment. That's how bad it was. Where do you stand on players being gagged, Sam? Have you had any similar instances of this?
I'm not sure they were gagged, were they? I thought I saw Dale Stevens on Match of the Day come out and speak after the game. I'm not sure about that. I just have this vision of him explaining away a situation and looking rather perturbed. But
maybe that's the interview they have to do, I think, with Premier League television. But certainly, yeah, they didn't do anything. They didn't go through the mix zone, didn't do any radio. And I spoke to someone at the club afterwards, and he said that their manager didn't want them to speak.
Well, players being locked in rooms after games or being gagged, I mean, the idea being that the longer you keep the press waiting, the more likely it is that they'll give up and go away. It's a tactic that they use quite a lot. I mean, obviously we had the Pogba one when he was gagged and he walked through the mix zone saying, I can't say anything, what do you want me to do, get killed or something. I wanted to interview Heung-min Son the other week on a sort of slightly different tact because he scored the first goal at the new Spurs stadium, and I was in the tunnel afterwards. And he was standing in front of me and we were having a conversation. And I suggested, come on, look, you've scored the first goal at the new stadium. Just give me 2 minutes, just a little sound bite, just to talk about it. And he's happy to do it, it's fine. And he's smiling away and we're having a proper chat. And he said, look, I will do it, but I've just got to check because I don't want to get in trouble. I was like, just do it. Anyway, he had to go away and check. He went away and checked and the press officer said, no, he's got too many to do, he's too busy. And I thought, he's standing right there. Yeah. We could have done it. We could have had it done. It was never going to be a bad thing. It was only going to be just one sentence. You scored the first goal at the new stadium. How important is that? Oh, it's so great to do it. Blah, 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 blah. Even if he'd just said that to me and walked off, I'd have been happy.
I hate that. Sorry, before you move on, because, Ray Stubbs alludes to this later in his interview. In the old days, he used to have the likes of Bob Paisley's number and be able to ring him up at home. I mean, one of the biggest managers of all time. We used to be able to stop players in the car park after games. And now, clearly in that situation, Son was happy to do the interview. He was probably buzzing, I'd have thought, after scoring the first goal at the new stadium. Why stop him doing it? There was another incident at a Premier League club this week where their sponsors had actually organised interviews without the club's knowledge of two or three of their players. The club got wind of this and they canned the event. They pulled the players out because they didn't trust them to speak without somebody stood next to them recording their every word. I just wonder, when did players stop being adults? When could they not be trusted? Especially for a nice story like that, to actually just give their own opinion. It infuriates me.
What are they going to say? What is it they're going to say that you're so worried about? I don't get it. What are they going to say? I mean, it's not as if they're going to come out with a Donald Trump-esque line and tank the pound. They're only going to talk about football, I would expect. And if they are going to talk about any other subject, well, good. At last. I mean, look at the way that Gareth Southgate has approached the England setup. I think that should be a measure for what people do. Look, and it does need controlling. You do need to get a handle on what players are saying when, and there is a media management that needs to take place because of the fact that it's so big now and it's a juggernaut of a league. But come on, get a little bit real about it. You know, at the end of the day, we are, as you say, all adults. Pep was in fiery mood in the tunnel at Selhurst Park this week. That's another one, actually, that comes out in the corner. And it's very tiny, very, very tight. And something that he mentioned was the fact that it's the smallest locker room in the Premier League at Selhurst Park. And, you know, going from the big Tottenham one to this one is different, but we adapt. He spoke a lot about consistency. And I got the feeling that he was really stung by the criticism that came his way after the Champions League first leg. He had a very sarcastic dig at What he said was, all the pundits and the specialists who blame the manager's mistake. Well, I'm sorry. But if you get 183 points over 20 months, you're doing it week in, week out in the Premier League. That's how you become a great team. Being there every game, week after week. I won three leagues with Barcelona. I won three leagues with Bayern Munich. I've won a league here and I'm in contention for a second one. If I win the Premier League, I love the Premier League more than the Champions League, he said, then that's more important to me. He doesn't like criticism, does he? I mean, he's a great coach. He really is a very, very, very good coach, and his team are wonderful. It wasn't much of a match. I get the feeling sometimes when City play now, it's like the opposition are more interested in just trying to not look stupid by conceding 7 or 8 goals than they are in contesting the game. Palace didn't play any football until minute 81. In which case they were already 2-0 down. They scored a goal from a free kick and then thought, oh, we might have a go here, and then conceded again. But he clearly gets affected by what people say. And although he says, they all say, I don't read newspapers or I don't watch any of the fallout. Well, he obviously does, because he knows exactly what people have said about him.
I've asked this to a couple of pundits that I've been working with over the course of the weekend. So they've won the League Cup. I think they will win the FA Cup. I just don't think Watford
have enough big shouts there, Crooks,
to beat them at Wembley. No, but here's the shout, right? I think Liverpool should now go on and win the Premier League, because I think City will drop points somewhere and Liverpool's games all look very winnable. I thought all along that City won't win the Champions League. I told you they go out to Tottenham. I'm halfway to being proved right there. If they win the two domestic cups, for most clubs, a domestic double would be a fantastic season. For Manchester City, having been in a position at one stage where they could win all four, if they only win the League Cup and the FA Cup, is that a season of failure?
No, it's not a season of failure, and I'll tell you why.
Because, is it a season of underachievement?
No, and this is the reason why. Because in the Premier League this season, we've got two teams that are the third and fourth best performing teams in terms of points per game in the top flight's history. So going back to when there was first a group of, I think 1914, there was first a group, not 1914, probably before that, there was a group of teams that were over 20 in the first division or whatever, a reasonable amount of teams. But if you adjust the points per game total from that sort of era right the way to now, there's only two teams that have got a better points per game ratio than Manchester City and Liverpool in this current season. So when I said earlier in the season that this is a rarefied Premier League, it really is. These are the two of the best teams in terms of consistency of performance that have ever played the game in this country. So if they lose out to Liverpool, they are losing out to a once-in-a-generation performing team. Now, that may well be adjusted by the fact that you think that the other teams in the league are crap. And some of the teams, especially towards the bottom, have certainly proved that in Fulham and Huddersfield. That won't be the case next year, because you'll have teams that come up that will invest a lot more money and that are bigger powerhouses and can attract different types of players, I would have thought. But ultimately, you have to give credit where credit's due. And these two teams, both of them, Liverpool and Manchester City, are very, very good. You say Manchester City will drop a point between now and the end of the season. They may not. They are that consistent and they are that good. They've won 23 of the last 25 games.
That's Sam Atterface of the Manchester City Supporters Club, Northwest Branch.
Oh, yeah. Check my Twitter for reasons why that's not the case.
People you know that can legitimately buy a pair of binoculars. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
You are listening to the All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast. It's time for this week's big interview.
Okay, I am in the brand new TalkSport offices overlooking the Thames with Ray Stubbs, who's just about to go on air. Ray, first of all, can I take you right back to the start of your career? How did you first get into broadcasting? What was your big break, would you say?
Well, I was a footballer for my hometown club, Tranmere Rovers. Not a very good one. And my local football club employed me for a decade because I was 5 years there a player, not very good. And then I was 5 years working in the offices there in the commercial department. And so football was what I knew. And having made an attempt to have a playing career and realised that wasn't going to work out, I remember seeing people arrive at the ground with these massive big tape recorders slung around their shoulders. And as if it's yesterday, I remember thinking, they're getting paid to talk about football. I'll have a crack at that. And it was from that that sort of gave me the inkling, the start, the desire to try and find out about sports broadcasting. So I worked quite hard. I sort of got very, very lucky. My first job in broadcasting was reading the pub scores on a Sunday for BBC Radio Merseyside. They had a programme called Sunday Sports Extra, which actually covered all the local Sunday leagues. The Liverpool Sunday League, the Birkenhead Sunday League, the Business Houses League. So reading those football scores and reporting on pub football was really my start in broadcasting, and sort of got lucky again. Next minute I'm covering a fourth division game or a third division game. Next minute I'm covering Everton and Liverpool. This was the mid-80s. Liverpool and Everton were absolutely dominating. So I was very, very lucky, and a lot of people gave me a lot of help. It was a great area to work in, as you can imagine. It was a very different era. You'd be phoning Howard Kendall up at home on a Sunday night, asking him if all was well. You'd be phoning Mr. Paisley at home on a Sunday evening, saying, is all well, any injury news? And just the concept, Alex, of in those days having home phone numbers for football managers, phoning them and them actually taking the call. It's not better, it's not worse. It's just a very different era. So my start in broadcasting was sort of based on my knowledge of football through working for Tranmere Rovers, and then getting a lucky break and a lot of people helping me just pick up the bits and pieces. I regret not having a background in broadcasting, but those degrees you could do in broadcasting didn't exist in those days. I was always held in high regard, the print journalists I met and worked alongside, because they were actually trained in the job. I just had to pick it up as I went along, and I've been trying to get away with it ever since. It's a long time ago.
And how did you go from working for the BBC at a local level to then presenting Grandstand and Match of the Day, two of the flagship shows on the network?
I'd grown up watching programmes like that, and it's, for my generation, it was part and parcel of sports broadcasting. And many other ITV's channels as well, but there were the days of, there was ITV and BBC, and there was nothing else. World of Sport on a Saturday afternoon was a big part of sporting culture. But for me, Grandstand and Match of the Day and Football Focus and watching David Coleman do Final Score, I grew up with things like that. It was a strange way how I sort of made that next step. I got lucky again. The BBC Broadcasting had a system called it was the version of the loan system, but it was called the attachment system. And you could get an attachment, which was a loan effectively, to go and work for someone else. So I actually went to work for a Question of Sport. So I worked on a Question of Sport for three or four seasons, learned an awful lot from David Coleman, wrote questions, made little films, researched them with a videotape that they use on the programme. I worked as a producer, an assistant producer, on the snooker, the bowls, the darts. So I got a grounding, I guess, in the production side of television. And then got lucky again, worked on a programme called On the Line, which made films about sporting issues, things in sport that deserved a little bit more an in-depth look at. I worked for On the Line. I got lucky, and all of a sudden I'm working on Match of the Day, Grandstand, Sports Night. I'm working within those teams as a reporter, and I got lucky. I have to say that when you consider the broadcasters that were working on those programmes, being on the bench and being brought off the bench to present Grandstand, to present Match of the Day, to present Sports Night, to present Football Focus, to present Final Score. Well, as I say, they were the programmes I grew up with. So an incredible thrill for me to be able to say, well, I once had an opportunity to say hello and say goodbye on those programmes. It's very generational because that's where I was at in those days. Years and years before the broadcasters of today were doing their stuff. It's not better, it's not worse, it's just different. But that was my era.
It is very different now. We've got 24-hour sports news channels, highlights of every Premier League game, which hasn't always been the case. Do you think there would be a place for a show like Grandstand in the current schedule, or do you think it's had its day?
I think it's there in different guises. Grandstand used to be under an umbrella. So on a Saturday lunchtime, and it was just, it's not better, it's not different. One of my favourite phrases, by the way. The fact is that we would start on a Saturday lunchtime and you'd actually say, this is the menu for the day. And it'd be football focus, it'd be racing from somewhere, it'd be a rugby union international, it'd be an athletics meeting, it would be snooker, it would be test cricket sometimes. And then all building towards final score just before 5 o'clock. So that's what it was there now. The world of broadcasting completely changed. And I understand how that all needed to move on. But now it's still there in different guises, because you will have this programme on one channel covering that live sport, this programme on another channel covering that live sport. You'll be pressing a red button to get action from here, there or wherever. You'll be going to not one other channel, it was BBC and ITV. You're going to 4, 5, 6 other channels getting sport. So I think the viewer is very well served, very well served.
Just to touch on one of your BBC colleagues, Des Lynham, for me growing up, was the sort of oracle of sports broadcasting. Was he as smooth in person as he came across on the screen?
More so. Really? More so. What a performer. What a nice bloke, by the way. Very, very helpful. Very, very generous. If you went to him to ask advice, he would impart advice. He was fantastic at what he did. And he had an aura about him. He was just so cool, as you say. And Des followed on from David Coleman, who did it in a different way. And there's no good, anyone working in broadcasting, there's no good trying to be somebody else. It was more about just be yourself and hope that works. So David had his style, Des had his style. Steve Ryder, consummate professional. And many others that I was lucky to work with. I would say be yourself and hope that engages with an audience. As Des said to me once, people are inviting you into their front room. I think it's wise to be polite. Great phrase.
Yeah, fantastic.
Because you were joining them in their house, so act accordingly.
Yeah. And there are similarities between yourself and Des in that he obviously left the BBC to go to ITV. You took a slightly different route. You went to ESPN. Looking back now, would you change anything about that decision? Obviously, you were the main anchor for 3 years covering Premier League football for them.
I wouldn't change a second of it, because I don't think you should ever look back in situations like that. I think chapters in life, chapters in your career, it was the right time for me to move on to do something else. And this was to present Premier League football, to present FA Cup football, to present Scottish Premier League football, which I have a great affection for, to present Europa League football. So it was a great challenge to present Premier League football live, week in, week out. Then to get to present an FA Cup final. I had nothing but wonderful years at the BBC, about 27 of them in all, I would say. But it was time to do something different. And the colleagues and the friends that I met and formed at ESPN, I really enjoyed that chapter. It was fantastic.
And here we are now. You mentioned Europa League there. You're about to present Chelsea away in Slavia Prague on radio now for Talk Sport 2. Clearly, you still love the game.
Well, yeah, I think that I like trying to communicate with people, because what do we do? I can take it all the way back, Alex, to when I was working at Tranmere Rovers and I saw people turning up with big tape recorders, interviewing people. And basically, they were talking about football, and that's what we do today, and other sports too. But we talk about football, and it commands national radio stations, commands so many sports channels. It's a huge part of society, and I think TalkSport 2 has done a fantastic job in bringing so much more live sport to the arena. This week we've had commentaries from the Championship. We've got commentary tonight on the Europa League. There'll be top-class rugby union tomorrow night. There'll be Premier League football at the weekend. Commentaries come back to back. And the thrill of live sport, absolutely, is what people want to hear.
And never been diluted for you. You still love it as much as you did way back then.
I'm going to hang on for as long as possible.
And just finally, I can't let you go without asking about your biggest fan, Noel Gallagher.
Well, I'm not sure that's absolutely accurate, but I have to say it's something that I am very, very proud of. If anyone doesn't know the story, Noel turned up. It was the wrap party for the 2006 World Cup in Germany. And we should know better, or I should know better, especially at my age. There was a drinking game involved, and I was quite good at it, actually. And, and I took part in this drinking game. And Noel subsequently wrote about it. I think it was in The Guardian. Yeah. I think it was in The Guardian. And I keep promising that I'm going to get that and have it printed up and put on the wall. I haven't as yet. But to read Noel speak about me in such generous terms, given I am a massive Oasis fan. A massive Oasis fan. Yeah, I have to say, it is. If you talk to me about big moments, it's right up there, very near the top.
Good old Ray. And he should get that framed and put on his wall. I mean, that's an achievement in itself to go drinking with Noel Gallagher. Very impressive. And listen, he's a great man, Ray, a brilliant broadcaster. And what he was saying about Dez and Steve Ryder, in their day, you know, 90s and 2000s, they were what everybody looked up to. I mean, I know that that they've all gone on and done other things since, but I thought they were so smooth and so technically very, very good. It's not easy to link those live outside broadcasts, and they did it without ever making any mistakes, which I always thought was very, very impressive.
Yeah, just listening to Ray there, and thanks for his time, because he'd been a bit under the weather, so I really appreciate him doing the interview for us. Des Lynam, you know, was my broadcast hero growing up. The way, as Ray said in that interview, that he came into your living room every Saturday night and just shared your living room with you. He was so smooth. He was so professional. He knew the right thing to say at the right time. I don't think we will see the like again. I don't think there is an anchor at the moment on a level with Des Lynam. And that's no disrespect at all to anybody who's doing the job currently.
Well, I'll say that I think at the moment one of the best football anchors who is out there is Rebecca Lowe. She works for NBC in the United States of America. She started on TalkSport answering the phones about 15 years ago, 18 years ago. And she has graduated through to the Beebs, Atlanta, ESPN, and then at NBC. And we're going to speak to her next week. She's effortless. And if you ever get the chance to watch on NBC, the program that they do is fantastic. But the way she anchors it is something to behold. So I think you'll hear a lot more about her in the upcoming years. But yeah, she's coming on the program next week. So that'll be interesting.
Brilliant. And we've got some good guests, haven't we, between now and the end of the season. We've also got the angriest man in sport radio, Mark Saggers, in a couple of weeks' time.
I've recorded that already, actually. And he's again, very good about some of the commentators that he's worked with. So we'll get into that as well. You can follow us, by the way, on Twitter or Instagram at AFC Gigs. I wanted to pull you up on something. Because when we were practicing for this podcast today, and I know Michelle's not here to act as referee, but you started to try and have a little jibe at me about Ralph Hasenhüttl. And you were saying, oh, you thought he would take them down, and you said Southampton would go down. Well, good news for you is, unlike you, I've done a little bit of research on this subject. And actually, I'd like to remind you that back in October, we did a podcast, which was entitled Expected Goals and More, in which I told you right at the beginning that Southampton wouldn't go down because they create enough chances to stay up. And you were very sceptical. No, it's going to be too difficult, blah, blah, blah.
Mark Hughes was the manager then, wasn't he? And I stand by the fact if Mark Hughes had stayed, they would not only be relegated, they would have been relegated along with Huddersfield and Fulham already.
That's poor analysis, because ultimately a football club over the course of its year, especially one that's struggling at the bottom of the table, has a high percentage chance of changing its manager, therefore getting a bounce at some stage. So you hadn't factored that in. I clearly had when telling you that they were going to stay up, and you didn't. You were dismissive of that. But now you're trying to change the narrative in a very sort of Trumpism type of way to try
Fake
and
news.
Suggest to people on social media that it is me who said that they would go down. The only thing I have said about Hasenhüttl is that, in reaction to what you said, when you said if Hasenhüttl, because you were having a bit of a loving, you sort of got a little bit of a bromance going on with him, haven't you? I don't know if it's because on your patch and you have to lick his arse or what it is, but you're very much sort of like, Ralph is wonderful, he's saved.
Whoa,
saints.
Whoa, whoa.
You know, all this.
The
kind
one
of
thing
stuff.
That you know is that I'm certainly not an arse licker.
You do tweet a lot about him, don't you? You're not an
I think
an
he's great.
An Hasenhüttl licker.
I think he's great. I think he could be the new Pochettino. And I'm a big fan of Pochettino.
Go from sort of 0 to 100 mile an hour very, very quickly. Yeah. There's no in between for you, is it? They're either absolute heroes and wonderful people, or they're an absolute nightmare. Mark Hughes was your saviour when he first turned up, on the basis, basically, that he gave you a few lines. And then all of a sudden, he became the worst manager in history very quickly. There's no in between. Let me just back up some of what you're saying, though, with statistics, because Southampton had won just one game out of 15. And were a point behind Huddersfield when Ralph Hasenhüttl took over. Right, they've picked up 8 wins in 18 since then, and they're now 22 points above Huddersfield. That is some turnaround, and I will give him credit for that. But 8 wins
especially,
in 18 isn't earth-shattering.
Especially,
all I
no,
ever said
but he
was,
didn't sign a single player in January.
But that's because they had no money, but he knew that when he came in. But
yeah,
he
so what he's done, though, he's basically taken Mark Hughes' team that are underperforming so badly... And made them better. And I'm a big fan of that, because I've always said to you...
That's what a manager that is, should do.
And that is Pochettino's biggest strength, and that's where I make the comparisons. Pochettino is not a checkbook manager, which is lucky, because he works for Daniel Levy, who's the stingiest chairman in the history of football of all time. But what he does do, and we've seen this with the likes of Harry Kane, Dele Alli, Danny Rose, he gets players and he makes them better. And Hasenhüttl has done that. Look at Nathan Redmond. Someone suggested to me the other day that Nathan Redmond, had he have gone to Manchester City... when Raheem Sterling did, that Pep Guardiola could have done the same job on Redmond that he's done on Raheem Sterling. That's how much raw potential there is there. That may be overstating it for me.
I'm not sure that he would be Raheem Sterling, who is probably one of the most improved players I've ever seen in terms of the way... I mean, he was always very good, Raheem. He was always very good. His finishing was a bit of an issue, but he was a young player at the time. I mean, he's been fantastic. I mean, he was...
Yeah, I think that is overstating it. But with Redmond at Southampton, last season, he was the boo boy from the fans. Yeah.
And he didn't score any goals under Mark Hughes. He scored 8 under Hasenhüttl, which has got to be something to be credited to Ralph. My only ever point on Ralph is that you cannot say that... If they had gone down, it was nothing to do with him. Because if you've got 7 months to shape a team, to make a team, there is some contribution that you are having to it. If they go down, he has to take some of the responsibility. Yes, they'd have been 8th and all this kind of stuff. It's a different. It depends on the opponents you've got, where the fixtures are, what your rivals for relegation are doing. So there's loads of factors to take in. But ultimately, he was never going to be absolved of blame if they do go down. But he does get all the credit if they do stay up, which I think is fair.
Yeah, and just in terms of improving players as well, look at that back line, leaking goals for fun under Mark Hughes. Suddenly, Yannick Vestergaard looks like he is a very competent Premier League defender. I think that they're going to stay up, which is great news for me. It means I can feed the family for the rest of the season and into the summer. And I'm looking forward to next season, because I think he will ship some players out. He will bring some of his own men in. And I think Southampton could be the most improved team in the Premier League next season. Watch this space.
And what did you make of the rumours coming out of the Far East that China had almost as a state bought a stake in Southampton, or certainly that might well end up being sort of the case further down the line?
Yeah, I did a bit of digging on this. It was a very in-depth piece in the Financial Times. I went on TalkSport 2 to talk about it, did a piece for the papers as well. My understanding is, and this was reported at the time, that when Gao Jisheng, the owner, brought Southampton, he didn't do it from his company over in the Far East, Lander Sports. He set up a separate UK-based company, and therefore the sale of his company over in China to a state-backed firm isn't linked to the sale. Southampton are very confident if the Premier League are investigating, there is nothing untoward.
Look, there's nothing untoward even if it is owned by the Chinese state, because Manchester City are owned by Abu Dhabi's state, basically. So it's not as if there's anything wrong with it, but it's just whether or not that is happening, I suppose, because there's a lot of...
I suppose
of
also it goes against fair play, doesn't it, if you are owned by a country. I mean, it doesn't
Abu Dhabi
sit...
Owned yeah, Manchester and City.
So and we've spoken about this before. It doesn't really sit right that Manchester City's success is built on being owned by a country.
Well, I don't think it really matters if the financial fair play rules are not being broken. I mean, as long as that is the case, it doesn't matter who's funding it. As long as it's all fair and above board. And the same with China. Just because it's China doesn't mean that it's anti-competitive if the rules are being followed. I think the more interesting story about the Southampton thing is the idea that the Chinese are thinking about building a bridge between Southampton and the Isle of Wight, and getting involved in the infrastructure in and around Southampton. And that's one of the sort of key drivers to their investment. And I wondered whether or not there was any sort of movement on that, because that's a very big bridge.
yeah, might be a bridge too far, that.
Oh God, you've only been working on that one for a few minutes again.
Do you know what? It is the most expensive stretch of water in Europe, the Isle of Wight. I think it's literally a 10-minute ferry ride, and if you want to take a car over, you're paying about 150 quid.
Yeah,
to get
nightmare.
To the Isle of Wight. So I'd be a big fan of them building
radio shows over there. Many years ago, I used to have to do radio shows over there, and we had to... It was a nightly thing at one stage. We were going over there every night to do it, and it was so expensive. It was crazy. Getting over there, coming back, not getting back till midnight. Oh, nightmare. Look, we got some great stuff to talk about next week. I've got Porto-Liverpool upcoming in the Champions League, and then I'm going off to Sunderland-Doncaster, Newcastle-Southampton, so I'll get to speak to Wreck-It Ralph. And on Sunday, I'm doing Everton versus Manchester United, which is a key game in the race to finish in the top four, which Manchester United won. Oh, we haven't talked about the fact that you had a bet with me about Manchester United finishing above Chelsea. We'll do that next week. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do. It's at AFC Gigs on Twitter and on Instagram as well. Have a good week, Crook. Hopefully Michelle's back next week.
Yep. Fingers crossed for that.
It's all over, I think. No.
Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.